saw Angel come down the pathway. Beautiful mountain. And in heaven I saw angels with me.
Join us on Thursday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. for CITR's third annual Access Day.
You can listen on the air at 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca for 6 hours of programming featuring content about accessibility, self-advocacy, social accessibility, and more.
There will be live performances by musicians from the Vancouver Adaptive Music Society, an interview with Accessible Media Incorporated, and segments on employment, accessibility of arts and culture spaces in Vancouver, and more.
Visit CITR.ca for more information.
$1 billion. The question is, who let the dogs out?
CITR Radio 101.9 FM, Discorder Magazine, and Mint Records present Hot Dog Days. It's a monthly concert and video series at What's Up Hot Dog featuring local acts, good food, pinball, and high fives. Admission is free, the event is all ages, and you can buy a hot dog. The next Hot Dog Day is Tuesday, May 23rd at 8 p.m. with Hygiene and Shrouded Dance. Hot dog. Hot dog. 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 Hot dog.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Good afternoon. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. And my name is Madeline Taylor. You are tuned in right now to Shoes on a Wire, your weekly talk show where we talk about stories, have interviews, and all kinds of things to think about. So this week I have a very special guest with me in studio. I have Una Craig, who is a coordinator in addictions and mental health, and also works as a writer and educator who works through an oppression-informed lens. We have a lot to talk about this hour. We're going to be talking about her work in anti-oppression, although she's got a lot to say about that term specifically. We'll also be talking about the fentanyl crisis and gentrification in Vancouver. And we'll see where else the conversation takes us. But to start things off here on this hour of Shoes on a Wire, we have a song. This is a pick by Una. This is PJ Harvey with Rid of Me.
Don't leave.
So that was PJ Harvey with Rid of Me, a song request by my guest, Una Krieg. Hi, Una.
Hi.
First of all, thank you for coming in today. I know you've got a very busy life, but why don't you tell me why you picked that song?
Oh, geez. When you asked me about what songs I liked, I had like a 90s nostalgia moment, and all of a sudden I was just enjoying all my favorite Vancouver bands from the 90s, and not that PJ is from Vancouver, but just that era, PJ got me through. She got me through the early 90s and, made me feel okay about my sexuality and my gender and my body and my passion, and she was so intense and uncompromising, sort of unflinching in this, like, barrage of male music that I was also attracted to. That's it.
I had similar feelings about Hole, but I feel like now I need to have a PJ Harvey moment.
Hole fills that same sort of like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Place.
Totally. Sweet. It's okay. content warning for anyone listening. We're going to be talking about some intense subject matter in the next hour. We'll be touching on issues around the overdose crisis in Vancouver, gentrification, and we'll be talking about working through oppression and trying to do better from the perspective of us in this room. My name is Madeline Taylor, and as I said before, this is Una Krieg. Una, do you want to introduce yourself beyond what I said at the top of the hour?
Wow, yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Una. Hi, everybody in listening land. My name's Una. I have a lot of labels that go around depending on what hat I'm wearing that particular day. But for the most part, I live, work, and play on this beautiful, unceded, and stolen territory of the Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, and Musqueam nations. And I try to put that at the center of my day on a regular basis. I love living here. I wasn't born in Vancouver. I moved here when I was 19. And so, I just really, sorry, did I say 19? 14. Mm-hmm. I'm nervous. I just realized I'm also super nervous. And I have done a lot of things. So for 11 years, I smashed all the clocks that I had. I refused to stand in a bank line. I made art. I waged guerrilla art fair on this fair city of ours with my friends who died in the AIDS epidemic in the 90s, a lot of them. We had a cohort. And I've suffered addiction issues. I've been homeless. My partner and I were homeless for 3 years together downtown, which really links me into some of the stuff that has happened there. And other times in my life, I go to school. I'm a student at UBC, but I also work in addictions and mental health. Everything is sort of centered in that knowing of what it was like to be homeless and, that using as a way of making it through that kind of thing. And I think because I rejected a lot of the rules of engagement when I was younger has given me a huge amount of experiences that are really hard to label in one body. But, now that I have a clearer mind, I can write about those experiences. And I think one of my favorite labels is I'm a parent. I have two amazing little children, Fury and Wolf, if you're listening. I love you. Yeah, and so that's one of my absolute favorite locations of identity that is really fun to explore.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Is that a good enough?
Of course.
Broad enough?
Well, and you know what? That's the great thing about having the option to introduce yourself is that there's no wrong answer, right? It's whatever makes the most sense for you to talk about. Mm-hmm. I wanted to invite you to come and talk with me on the radio today because a lot of the things that I've been thinking about recently, specifically things that are important in the media in Vancouver right now, the overdose crisis, gentrification, just feeling frustrated with political systems, not knowing exactly how to navigate that as mm-hmm. someone who's still doing a lot of work personally to try to address my own areas of privilege, that sort mm-hmm. of thing. We don't know each other super well, mm-hmm. but I met you doing an anti-oppression workshop the day after Donald Trump was elected as the president of the United States. I personally remember it as a very emotionally charged couple of hours.
The most intense workshop I've ever run.
Yeah. It was a lot. It was a lot all at once. So whether real or not, I felt very supported by you at that time. And also very interested to know more about who you are. Hmm. So, and you've done some writing for Discorder magazine most recently on issues of the overdose crisis as well as gentrification. And as you said, gentricide in Vancouver. So that's why I invited you on the show today.
Awesome.
Yeah. And to start things off, we had a little bit of a discussion before we came on air here when we were picking out songs to play. Which was super fun because Una has amazing taste in, dare I say, feminist punk rock?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. but yeah, so I originally said anti-oppression work, but you have a different label for it. And so do you mind telling everyone listening what your perspective is on that and how you define it differently?
Sure. I used to run anti-oppression workshops and I get hired to do anti-oppression workshops in different organizations. And I realized after, I don't know, about a year, it's like I was really beginning to recognize that there is no such thing as anti-oppression. And it actually felt really disingenuous to say anti-oppression when really what we're trying to do is explain how oppression works and how oppression and privilege play out together that hold us on a three-dimensional web. As opposed to that it just being linear, this one thing. Because if I, if I attend an anti-oppression workshop and I walk out feeling really good about myself, then it's kind of a lie.
Yeah.
So anti-oppression became a bit of a trigger word for me, like indicating that there's a solution, and that in 3 hours or so that folks who, if they just take a little peek at their privilege, might be able to not be so oppressive. And I think that, yeah, that's true. It's really important that we walk lightly in areas where oppression exists, but that oppression is everywhere and it exists in all of our hierarchy, in all of our communication. It's inherent in our language. And so there's really no getting away from it. So it's more like, how do we inform ourselves about the consequences of oppression? And that gives me a little bit more freedom to step away from some of the narrative around just trying to uncover, you know, white fragility.
Yeah.
Which for the most part is what an anti-oppression workshop is about. So
yeah, I was going to ask, just in case we're talking over the heads of anyone listening, why, first of all, who would normally ask you to do an anti-oppression workshop, and what is the impetus for it, usually coming from whoever is asking you to do it?
Right. Well, it all began because I wanted to train volunteers to work with vulnerable populations. And I think that in a community setting, in order to create community, we need folks from many different echelons of that community to work with each other in order for we to develop vibrancy. People use the word diversity, but that's not really the word I'm looking for. I think vibrancy between human experiences has a better ring for it. For me, and a lot of folks, especially in the recovery community, we have some real stigma around like the divisions between harm reduction and abstinence. And I wanted to train volunteers who might be steeped in one way of looking at recovery or another, whether it be harm reduction or abstinence, that those demarcations can actually be really oppressive for folks who are just trying to find their way. And as volunteers in a community setting, that we need to really start looking at how do we not put our story on absolutely everyone. And that's how I started to develop this training, looking through a lens of oppression-informed practice in order to try to elicit the middle road, this place where we don't all have to agree, but we can see each other's human experiences and try not to be, replicating violence in our smaller communities. So lateral violence happens in small communities when people get really stuck in, it is only this way. And when we're working with folks who experience trauma and oppression, vulnerability on a regular basis, you can have the best intentions, but you can replicate the violence in the community quite easily.
So it's about like building empathy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And figuring out ways to get people out of their own experience. So it's like taking the fish out of the fishbowl and making it see the wider world a little bit.
Totally. Yeah. And taking a peek at, you know, how one identity can erase other identities. And that in the erasure of that identity is a violence upon itself.
Right. Yeah. I know I'm a white settler living on Musqueam territory in East Vancouver right now. And a lot of the ways that CITR and this organization has been trying to use some of those ideas is to make sure that our leadership isn't blinded by our personal experiences. So I think that's one of the big reasons that we invited you to come talk with us.
Unsettling yourself is a really excellent start to and feeling unsettled is how you know you're in the right territory. When it comes to looking at oppression, and also knowing that, you know, your story isn't the same as everyone else's story. Yeah.
Yeah. And that neither are wrong necessarily.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, absolutely. That's the, you know, it's inherent. These are inherent. It means we've inherited it. this way. And so if we see it, then we can change it. But we have to know what it is that needs to change in order to move forward. Mm-hmm. Right? That's sort of my opinion. So going back to what you were asking on how people hired me, is I created this program and then word got out. And people started asking me if I did stuff on the side. And so I created, I also work for Groundswell, which is an organization that's a very small business community. And so it's called a slow business. And it's a grow your own business economy, which is really interesting. So they asked me to do some workshops. I did some workshops with them. I worked with them with youth in a project a couple of years ago. And then anyone who gets to know me in the community and finds out that I like to run these workshops has kind of just ended up hiring me.
Yeah, well, it's useful work that I think most people would benefit from if they had the opportunity to learn about it. Mm-hmm. It's something that that strain of empathy, and also based on some of the life experiences that you mentioned mm-hmm. when you were introducing yourself, I noticed in the writing that you did in Discorder, mm-hmm. Which is the writing that I've read by you. And as I mentioned, the overdose crisis is something that has an impact on my life and huge impact on our collective communities in the last couple years. And yeah, I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about the article that you wrote in Discorder magazine on the overdose crisis, talking about the numbers of deaths in Vancouver as a result of drugs laced with fentanyl. When we met, I remember you had been talking about this piece as something that you were working on. Where did it initially come from for you?
Well, I mean, I'm steeped in the addiction recovery community, having had a lot of that on lived experience myself. So I'm very aware of the stigma around addiction. And my partner is an outreach worker downtown. So he was front and center for a lot of the crisis and what started happening on the streets last year. We noticed a huge difference in what was going on the street in, I guess it was about April of last year, that it was really like you couldn't look away. There was no way to deny that, you know, ambulances are going 24/7, and like our house is so steeped in the crisis that my kids know what fentanyl is. They know where the Narcan kits are. They know how to call 911. Not that anyone in my family is necessarily going to need it, but just that that's how often the kids hear it. When my 4-year-old says fentanyl, he's like, did Dad use fentanyl today? And what he means is, did he revive somebody? And he has also decided that he doesn't want to be a lifeguard. So it was really personal, but the main impetus for writing the story was my best friend died of an opioid overdose. And I learned a lot about how my biases might have potentially isolated her in a way that was life-threatening. And so that was really what started me wanting to write this, is that the stigma of the word addict and the word heroin has it in itself is killing people. And if you notice, like, nobody mentioned it during the last election because it was a political suicide to do so, which is really sad, because we've had, since the last election, over 2,400 people have died. To put it into context, SARS came to Canada. 4 people died of SARS. They put $15 billion into solving the SARS crisis. Mm-hmm. 4 people. 2,400 people have died in Vancouver or in British Columbia since 2013. When was the last election?
I am honestly not sure.
Since whenever the last election was.
Yeah.
Over last month alone, we had over 120 people die. It's one person is dying every 8 hours. And there's no political will to do anything about it because of the stigma of addiction. And so I really wanted to write about how a location like downtown Eastside has become a label. It's not in itself a, it is a place, but it's also a label that creates a bunch of stigma and that dehumanizes the experience of the people there. Granted, you know, a little over half of the folks who have died in BC from the fentanyl crisis have been linked to the downtown Eastside. Most of the folks are BC residents, you know, and so then we're talking about human beings of every socioeconomic class, race, gender. Yeah, so we have humans, souls who are no longer here, and it really upset me, the sort of pushback from people in social media saying, you know, we don't want to pay for junkies and, you know, oh, it's the thing that really bothered me is someone said it's culling. It's a culling. Oh, it's just, you know, it's idiots who are just dying and so they should deserve to die. And I was horrified by this narrative that was unfolding when the city was trying to raise some money to do something about it because the BC government wouldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, I it's one of those things where when the word crisis almost becomes cheapened because you hear it so often, but those numbers should be horrifying and those words should mean something to the people hearing them. But yeah, I lost an incredibly close friend to an overdose at the beginning of February. And when I was talking, I've been talking with my parents about it a lot. Since then, they've mentioned that it's similar in feeling to the AIDS crisis of the late 90s and the early, late 80s and the early 90s. And similarly, there was so much stigma at the time and continues to be stigma around HIV and AIDS. Yeah, and it's just, it's interesting to see those mistakes playing out again when it comes to talking about quote-unquote addicts and drug users as though there's somehow a deserved death sentence that comes along with what a lot of the medical community would agree is a disease. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I found your piece very powerful. What do you think of some of the media attention that the crisis has gotten so far? And how can it do better?
I think we have some really great, I think the Georgia Strait's done a really great job of following this crisis in a fairly human manner. But I think that it's really easy to get caught up in the visuals of the downtown Eastside, which really just can reinforce a lot of the narratives of that folks who are using are folks who are in poverty and, you know, the sort of like, was it 24 or maybe one of the Daily Metro or something like that, that had like a powder across the table and a needle. And I just like, I feel like if we really want to fight the crisis, we have to look to the root of what is causing the crisis to being allowed to continue. I mean, this was anything else, people would be, you know, if fentanyl was in people's Botox, people would be so upset about it. And I'm pretty sure that Christy Clark, and maybe this is like really opinionated, but would do something about it if her friends were dropping dead at a rate of every 8 hours, that someone who was using Botox would go ahead. I mean, that's a choice that people are making to modify how they look. You know, drugs modify how we feel. The systemic reasons and why they would continue or where places that they put, I'm not really able to make a consideration about them, but I don't want to replicate the violence of those images and how they continue that narrative of the bad addict that needs to be put into, you know, and we're like, what is going on at the federal level is mandatory treatment is a terrible idea. Because then again, we have a system that qualifies certain people as being bad and needing needing to be controlled in a certain way, and that has not worked. Mm-hmm. You know, prohibition hasn't worked. You know, we could actually link a lot of what is going on now to the narratives of prohibition from the early 1900s.
Well, and the war on drugs as well. Similar language, if not the same language.
It totally is. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and the idea of the bad addict, and even just the idea of someone who uses drugs as a criminal. I think it's something that people forget was an invention by the government. Mm-hmm. It's not something that is inherent. And like the ways that, even just looking at the use of opiates, which from what I understand is where the majority of fentanyl overdoses, is from the use of opiates is where the majority of fentanyl overdoses are happening right now. The ways that they have been used historically has been highly linked to class and issues of race. And that stigma didn't erupt overnight, but it's also not natural. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, excuse me. It's just interesting to watch. It's interesting and heartbreaking to watch how complicated this issue is to even talk about in a way that people can understand if they don't have direct experience. So
I think that human beings have a hard time with new ideas, and it's really difficult to graft a new idea onto a closed mind. And I also think that people react physically to the exact same way to a physical harm as they do to an emotional one. And so, for the most part, a lot of the reason that I'm trying to get under the skin and not, I don't want to get people to react to the information, but I'm trying to humanize the information so that they can see to not have that visceral reaction. People are scared. This crisis isn't going away. As a matter of fact, it's getting worse. And so there's no easy solution. There's no universal brush. We need a spectrum of care. We need to support all of the agencies that are providing the care that they are, but we also need to do so, so much more than that. And taking the stigma off of addiction is going to help with the with doing that. But in order to do that, we have to engage with people's minds so that they're not having their own trauma response to this mind-boggling problem. It's very easy to see it and just put it into the other category because it's so complex and it's so difficult and it's going to require a ton of work and in panel after panel of difficult conversation that engages with all the different parties who are involved in the crisis.
And all the different aspects of human suffering that are involved in the crisis. Yeah, it's a toughie, yeah, to say the very least. I want to give us a breather. I also want to give listeners a breather.
Yeah, probably.
I know it's heavy. But thank you for sharing your perspective and your experiences on that topic. I know it's not an easy one to communicate about, but it's really important right now. Okay, changing tracks. I'm going to play a song by a band called 10 Days Late. This was, again, Una's suggestion. Una, do you want to tell me a little bit about this band while I get the song queued up?
So anyone who was around in the 90s and was even remotely connected to the punk rock scene has seen 10 Days Late. They were a really great, fun, feel-good punk rock girl band. Just awesome. So, yeah, good feels.
Fantastic. Okay, well, it's time for a few minutes of good feels. This is a song called Angela's Revenge by 10 Days Late on Shoes on a Wire on CITR 101.9 FM.
Spell it out for all the times you don't understand me. Do I have to paint you a picture of all the things that you don't want to see? Do I have to spell it out?
Love the idea of empowering female youth through music creation and performance? Girls Rock Camp Vancouver is a 100% volunteer-driven nonprofit that promotes self-esteem and builds technical skills in female and non-binary youth ages 8 to 18. Help support this initiative by donating, volunteering, or attending their end-of-camp performance July 15th at the Rio Theater. If you're interested in being a camper or volunteering with Girls Rock Camp, visit girlsrockcampvancouver.ca.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Welcome back to Shoes on a Wire on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people here at the University of British Columbia. My name is Madeline Taylor, and I am here in studio today with Una Krieg, and we had a conversation before the break there about the opioid crisis and the overdose crisis, and how that's being dealt with and not dealt with in the city, and the impact it's had on our lives personally. So, welcome back, everyone. The songs you heard in the break were, first of all, by a band called 10 Days Late. You heard Angela's Revenge. They are a band from the late 90s, early 2000s. And apparently one of the members now owns Lanaloo's, the venue in the downtown east side, which is really cool.
Yeah, full circle.
Go support Lanaloo's.
Yeah.
They do all kinds of cool stuff.
And they have good food.
They do. Yeah. I got some poutine there once when I went to a storytelling event, and it may have been Lana who made it.
It may have been.
It may have been.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was great.
She's pretty rad.
Yeah. Women-owned businesses, support them.
Mm-hmm.
The second song you heard was by Dilly Dally. They are a band out of Toronto, and the song was Desire. They have been touring all over the place. The record Soar, where the song Desire was off of, came out actually in 2015, but I really like it, so you should listen to it.
Yeah, I'm going to listen to it as soon as I get home.
Yeah, it's very growly. It's some good rage music.
No.
Yeah. So for the second half of our conversation here, I wanted to talk about another article that Una wrote in Discorder magazine, this one more recently, and it was titled Gentricide.
Mm-hmm.
So to start things off, can you parse that word for us? What does that word mean?
Absolutely. So it wasn't my word. It was a word. I was walking around downtown, and it was written in red Sharpie on an alcove in one of the alleys in between Gore and somewhere. And it said gentricide. And a little further down the road was also another beautiful tag that said fentanyl eases gentrification. And I started thinking about those were these amazing inspirations that started sort of rolling around in my head. And I was curious as to what I get how it could feel when one out of every eight people in your community have died of a fentanyl overdose, how it can feel like a personal genocide. But I was interested to see if I could actually make the linkages in between ongoing colonization, land-based economy, the fentanyl crisis, and gentrification, and how that all comes together downtown. How that, when we look at the top down, how that the heaviness of all of those layers actually kill people. That was what inspired it.
How did you go about making that argument?
Well, I started studying the housing crisis. I thought that was a really good place to start, with the acknowledgement that the downtown east side used to be a collective area called Kemkemele, which is where the maples grow, or the land of the maples, or the place where the maples are, depending on who you hear it from.
And where's that word from?
I am not 100% sure. I think it's Squamish.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I know, Hunkaminam and Hulkaminam are similar languages. And so I think we would have understood, although Squamish is a different language, I think it was a common piece. I don't really know.
Yeah, but it was kind of a pre-colonization.
Absolutely.
Title.
And it's where seafaring and riverfaring folk would go and get paddles made. In the actual territory itself the actual area is a bog that used to grow cranberries and raspberries and blueberries. And so it was also a place of harvesting in this really beautiful little nook of the area. And I started thinking about how it's all stolen land, and that a land-based economy is based on the fact that somebody got the land cheap and is selling it high. And so I just started kind of building these arguments in my mind, the connection between colonialism and the genocide that was perpetuated and is still perpetuated upon the people of the first peoples of Turtle Island, which is Canada and the U.S. And I just wanted to make those links to the housing market. And then I started doing this like crazy research and getting, I actually, at some point I had to put it all down and had cried for about 3 days because the perpetuation of violence is palpable, and it's very easy to start following the lines along land-based economy, gentrification, and the death rate of folks who live in poverty. Mm-hmm. There's real connection between those pieces.
How have you seen the downtown east side change since you've lived in Vancouver as a result of gentrification?
So the gentrification, I've seen amazing things change since I was homeless downtown that come along from what, you know, some people might call, like, gentrification is a sort of loose term in itself. You know, in order for our community to be busy, we need different types of businesses in it. We need places to buy food and culturally appropriate venues, and we need music, and we need cheap places to drink and expensive places to drink, and we need you know, a walking economy. We need to know the people who are in our neighborhood. We need to know where to go play cards. You know, Chinatown has this really vibrant community that is being displaced by coffee houses, and that didn't happen downtown. What I saw happen downtown is when I was down there, it was Skid Row. It was more of a Skid Row than that. It wasn't called the downtown east side. And there was no services. As some of those businesses moved in, some of the businesses did hire and get connected to the community in a way that was really beneficial. The PHS, which was based off of Jim Green Residences.
Which PHS. Is the Portland Hotel Society, in case anyone hasn't heard that acronym before.
Absolutely. They started providing life-saving services for folks who couldn't access them. So when I was homeless, it was really hard to communicate with people. I didn't have a phone. I didn't have a shower. I mean, there was times where, you know, people are like, oh, why don't you just get a job? And I'd be like, I'd love to get a job, but, you know, I need to not have slept in a underground the night before, and I'm freezing cold, and I don't have shoes, and I haven't washed, and I don't think I brushed my teeth in like 3 weeks. And so different agencies started being able to provide those kind of things. So and there is a range of things available in the downtown east side that is significantly better than it was when I was homeless down there. And my favorite place was called the Drug Users Resource Center. And before that was called Life Skills. And it was a community run by the community members, community health center. So it was somewhere you could go get clean needles and crack pipes and a shower and a razor and shave your legs. I don't know if anyone likes shaving their legs and they can't shave them. And then they shave them that first time. It's like the best feeling in the whole world. You know, and at first, this agency was told that they were gentrifying that community, but they weren't necessarily. So since then, and what I'm seeing now is that combination of folks who are coming and moving in, but they're not connecting to the community that's already there. And that's the kind of gentrification that is problematic. So if you are paying $500,000 for your 200 square foot bachelor suite, and you don't actually live in that suite, and that suite is in the downtown east side, but there's no trickle down into the economy, that's a type of gentrification that is unacceptable because it's not adding to the community at all.
It's more displacing the community.
It's displacing the, exactly. It's displacing the community. Good prompt. Awesome. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that really disturbs me the most about, and I want to almost call it like neo-gentrification, which is more heinous than regular gentrification. Because, I mean, gentrification comes and goes. At, you know, there's at some point displacement then leads to other diversity in other communities. And gentrification itself, you know, if we looked at Wendy Peters, who is the Housing Coalition person, her definition of gentrification would be different than mine, for example. So we have these real wide spectrums on what gentrification is. But if we look at neo-gentrification, which is just commodifying space in a way that displaces all other people, we can start to see how that has happened through Vancouver and how it's really putting pressure on an already vulnerable population. So we can see it in Chinatown right now, probably more so than the downtown east side. And the problem with all of that is that this is a plan. So this housing crisis is a plan, but it wasn't called a housing crisis. It was called put as much money into your bank as you possibly can, Bob Rennie, and Bran Hill,
yeah,
and whatever the guy's name who used to work for the BC Liberals. And the housing market was, it was a plan to drive the housing market up to be as big a bubble as humanly possible. And because of the stigma of folks who live in poverty, it's okay to do it at the expense of their safety. And that, and it's, that is problematic. And that is a type of ongoing colonial imperial narrative that has been killing people since contact. And that is the problem. Not the folks who want to move into the community and they're a family person and they like making food and they're going to have tacos
like looking
for everybody.
For cheaper housing,
yeah,
which is, you know, normally gentrified areas are cheaper to begin with,
mm-hmm,
which, yeah, brings in, you know, artists and students and,
exactly,
young families, that sort of thing.
Which is that vibrancy,
yeah,
in between community members. So not everyone is the same, but everyone adds something to the community. Yeah, so Gentricide was an interesting article to write. I actually wrote about 5,000 words on how much I hate the housing economy, which then got parsed, thank you, good editing, Britt, into a more cohesive, less blamey, ragey article that was more specifically along the lines of how we can see how government has a conflict of interest in the housing market and how that housing market has been manipulated on purpose without consideration for how it's going to impact our most vulnerable peoples. And in the downtown east side, our most vulnerable peoples are disproportionately represented by the first peoples. Like in the urban Aboriginal community downtown is huge. And there's a disproportionate amount of folks who identify along the lines of Aboriginal heritage down there. And so those are also folks who are disproportionately represented in poverty and homelessness, levels of addiction, incarceration, so who have been criminalized. So that is pretty much how those things are linked together. I think I made that clear.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. It is. If anyone listening would be interested to read more about Gentricide, you can find Una's article at discorder.ca. The title of the article is Gentricide. And we need to wrap things up here. We're coming to the end of our hour. But I wanted to ask if you have any final thoughts that you wanted to share with people, mm-hmm, before we transition out with some music.
That was so fast. I just want to say that, you know, the idea of genocide is a really heavy one. And I think that if we look proportionately to a community of 18,000 people, where one out of every eight people have died in that community. That's when we start to look, we could say those numbers. But I, you know, I have been criticized for using this word, which again wasn't my term, but was what inspired my idea to look for those linkages between ongoing colonialism, land ownership, and death. And so for folks, you know, in Darfur or in Syria or in Israel who have actually experienced like a cultural extinction, for the First Nation folks in Canada and in the U.S. and First Nation folks in all indigenous areas, who have experienced extinction, it can sound trite, but I think in context to the smaller community, it needs to be seen that one out of every eight people is quite a few.
Yeah, one out of every eight people in I guess, would you call it the downtown east side in and around Chinatown?
Yeah.
It ends up adding up and makes people feel like they are under attack.
Yeah.
Not wrongly, I would argue.
Yep.
Well, Una, thank you so much for coming on the show today and for talking with me about these really complicated and difficult issues, but ones that are so important to us as active, engaged citizens in this city.
So, awesome.
Yeah.
Let's listen to some music.
Sweet. All right. So we're going to polish things off here with
with Muscle Bitches.
Muscle Bitches. So again, this was Una's suggestion. Una, tell me about Muscle Bitches.
All I can say is that they are rad. Again, I don't know. I was in a 90s frame of mind. And I loved watching these bitches do what they do on stage. And if you're out there, you beautiful babes, all the best to you.
All right. This is Muscle Bitches with a track called Oprah, because why would I be able to pick any song besides one called Oprah? And once again, you've been listening to Shoes on a Wire on CITR 101.9 FM. You can catch us again next week, Wednesday, 4 p.m. My name is Madeline Taylor. Thank you so much for tuning in. Everyone, take care.
Bye.
Tell my mother or my father, I've brought them pain and misery. Yes, I've disgraced them like no other. A singing barber's life I lead. Welcome, my friends, into my parlor. This song of sinners sets me free. Yes, I am lost without another to share a shave and symphony. I was but a child pushed into college. All day I dreamt of hair to tease, excelled at coiffure.